I'm going to be talking to you for 35-ish minutes about the role of intersectionality in social linguistics, particularly in sociocultural linguistic analyses of identity construction. I'm going to be using some examples from my recent research with LGBTQ plus youth groups as a case study for this. And yeah, I'll be really keen to take any questions or have any discussion after that. So yeah, I'll get started. So as an overview, what I'm going to be doing today is showing you how several young queer people use language to construct their identity. I'm going to be presenting you with three moments from my interviews with different young people in my recent study with LGBTQ plus youth groups in England, where basically factors other than their gender or sexuality are informing their identity construction. And that means I'm looking at how their talk reveals their experience of queer culture within the context of their experiences as young people who are Black, who are immigrants, who are in foster care, who are affluent, for example. Most of these examples appear in a book that's out later this year. It is not yet quite in press, which is why we've still got the copyright Shutterstock label over the image, but it's going to look something like that. I'm really pleased it's going to be coming out later this year. And what I'm doing in that book is trying to lay out a clear way of analysing intersectional identity construction using LGBTQ plus youth to illustrate that. So really, I'm trying to give a summary of that in this fairly brief talk today. Before I get into the nuts and bolts of all that, though, I think it is helpful to think about the broader context of this work. So for those not familiar with this area, I'm working within queer linguistics. That's an approach to studying language, gender, and sexuality that has specifically political aims. So we seek to reveal and problematize normative ideologies about gender and sexuality, which ultimately constrain us. It's also about critiquing discourses that render particular groups or practices as other or strange. So it's a fundamentally critical discipline drawing on queer theory as it's broadly conceptualized. So it's about destabilizing and disrupting binary divisions and normative expectations. We use that in queer linguistics to analyze language that's either produced by or presented about queer people, interrogating it to see how it reproduces and also challenges normativities. So basically, queer linguists are using linguistic techniques to fulfill the broad political goals of queer theory. And there's a really well-established body of work taking this approach, looking specifically at identity construction, and the majority of that looks specifically at queer identities. So how do we then analyze identity in queer linguistics? Well, there are lots and lots of different approaches to this, but I'm going to share today my understanding of identity and the framework that I choose to use. So I follow Buchholz and Hall's sociocultural linguistic approach, and they see identity as the social positioning of the self and other. And that understanding of identity, it really prioritizes what speakers do in their speech to position themselves as particular types of people. So that could be, for example, through the stances that they take in line with or against particular propositions. A lot of people using a sociocultural linguistic approach, like I am, take a qualitative discourse analysis approach, but it has absolutely been used in variationist social linguistics as well. But yeah, I'm analysing interactional moments to see how speakers position themselves in relation both to broader ideological identity categories, so things like gay or woman, for example, but also locally salient personas and roles, so things that might be more specific to a particular community of practice, for example. So, for example, I might take a stance like LGBTQ pride events are really important to me. And that would index my membership to the broad category of lesbian, which I belong to. But the context in which I say that would index additional different local identities as well. So, for example, if I say Pride events are really important to me, to a group of friends who are all queer activists, that stance might well enable me to position myself as politically minded. But if I said Pride events are really important to me to a group of friends who are all connected because of their love of clubbing, that stance might instead index me, index my identity as someone who likes to party, for example. So the point is that the assumption that my interlocutors would make about what I mean when I say I like Pride is going to depend on whether they I'm a member of a community of practice with them that is, say, political and activist based, or maybe more about partying and clubbing. In both contexts, I'd be indexing my identity as a member of the LGBTQ community, but the more nuanced meaning would depend on the local context. And that's very much how we look at things, taking a sociocultural linguistic approach. We're saying that identity is defined by the context in which it's produced. Of course, that means we can't consider identities like gay or trans to be monolithic or homogenous. The realization of those identities depends on the context in which that gayness or transness is made relevant. And that's why ethnography or participant observation is so key to this approach. To understand identity construction taking place, we need to understand the local context. We need to understand the local meaning of language use. And I'm going to talk shortly about the local context of my particular study and the ethnography that underpins the research that I'm going to share with you today. But given I've said we need to make sure we're not treating identity categories as homogenous or monolithic, whether they are broad and ideological or locally specific, this relates to intersectionality theory, which is a really key part of what I'm talking about today. So I'm going to try and do a quick introduction to intersectionality for those who may be less familiar with the theoretical underpinnings here. So intersectionality, in a nutshell, concerns the fact that we don't all experience our membership to particular macro categories like woman or gay in quite the same way. Our experience of these categories depends on the other categories we also inhabit. That might be to do with race, class, faith, and so on. For example, there are a number of us on this call who identify as female, but not all of those of us who identify as female will necessarily relate to that category in the same way. That's going to depend on a range of other factors: how old we are, whether we're racially minoritized or not, how affluent or poor we are, and so on. So what this means is that our various category memberships are intracategorical or mutually constitutive. So each category that we inhabit informs the other categories. So our experience of gender is informed by our race, our racialized experience is informed by our class, and so on. But what's really important is that intersectionality theory is much more than just a handy theory of identity in terms of being able to analyse the different facets that make up a person's experience. It's about structural inequality. It's about discrimination. The Black feminist scholars who first theorised intersectionality framed it as a theory of marginalisation. That's central to Kimberley Crenshaw's seminal work on the subject. And it's been described more recently by Collins and Bilge as a way of analysing through a power-conscious lens. More specifically, intersectionality looks at the ways that some people are multiply marginalised because of how different aspects of their identity intersect. I'd argue that we really need to draw more closely on the work of these scholars, including of Yuval Davis, whose theory of belonging I found to be exceptionally useful. So she focuses on individuals' social locations, the unique experiences we have because of the various categories we inhabit and the ways they intersect for us. That won't be the same for other people. And finally, as Yep argues, a thick approach where we prioritise people's individual lived experiences is really important. That allows us to understand intersectionality in practice. That means not just focusing on marginalisation, actually, but also looking at how people are privileged as well, because, of course, that can reveal how structures of power intersect in ways that marginalise others. So what I'm doing today is trying to illustrate this particular approach, this intersectional approach, and to show its applicability in queer linguistics. Because everything I've said so far about intersectionality theory, as it's been developed in the social sciences, fits really neatly alongside well-established theories in queer linguistics. Both queer linguistics and intersectionality theory problematize the idea of identity categories being fixed, static, or homogeneous. As I mentioned before, the sociocultural linguistics approach in particular also frames identity categories as a resource we draw on in the construction of identity. So we position ourselves in line with macro categories as well as other things, but we actually produce them through interaction. So this all fits together really well. I'm far from the first person to call for an intersectional approach in queer linguistics. The likes of Erez Levon, Holly Cashman, and Bill Leap have all come before me. But what's important to note is not all work in queer linguistics has necessarily been closely aligned with scholarship from the social sciences, as I've just described it. That means focused on marginalisation or on individuals' social locations. In particular, as scholars such as Cornelius and Miles Hercules have recently argued, not all research in language, gender and sexuality that purports to be doing intersectional analysis is necessarily engaged with the fact of power and inequality. So what I'm trying to do in my book and here today is to bring marginalisation to the fore by focusing explicitly on marginalised speakers, in this case, LGBTQ youth. So I'm going to introduce the context of my research in a minute. I promise I will get past the theory shortly. I just first want to explain some kind of key principles that are really underpinning everything that I'm doing here. And these principles that I've set out in the book, they're drawing together everything that I've just talked about. So they're drawing together work from sociocultural linguistics, from queer linguistics, and from intersectional feminism. So I'm arguing that key to a robust intersectional sociocultural linguistic analysis is work that's intracategorical in its outlook, that considers both oppression and privilege, takes a thick approach to look at social locations, understands speakers to be agentive, and is reflexive. Now, these first three points I've just talked through already, I'm not going to repeat them here, but this fourth point about speaker agency, that reflects the fact that even those speakers who are marginalised in multiple ways, they're still agents in their own positionality, and they can be empowered in how they bring their identities into being. Speakers can be marginalised but still actively negotiate, challenge, subvert and recontextualise the ideologies that circulate around the categories they inhabit and the subsequent oppressions they face. I've seen this in my own previous research with LGBTQ plus youth, where speakers actively subvert the discourse of others that seeks to marginalise and other them. So I think it's really crucial that when we're analysing marginalised identity construction, we take care to avoid reinforcing our participants' oppression by framing them as weak and powerless. It's really important to demonstrate the agency they have in these moments. And this fifth point about reflexivity really speaks to the fact that when we're engaged in intersectional analysis, we need to reflect on how our own social locations have an impact and consider how our relative privilege or marginalisation impacts on the data that we collect. So we may share some social locations with participants, but we'll also have some that differ from them. And that's inevitably going to influence their behaviour towards us as well as our behaviour towards them. That includes the speakers we recruit, our sampling approach, the questions that we ask in interviews, how we interpret the data. And also, crucially, it includes things that we don't see because we're not a member of the same marginalised group which means we might not notice particular microaggressions. For example, in my case, that people of colour or trans people might feel very acutely, there might be things that I just might not see because of my privilege there. I'm going to draw on each of these principles in the data that I go through today, and I'll come back to this at the end. But now, finally, I'm getting onto the context of the data. Okay, so during the academic year 2018-2019, I carried out ethnography in four LGBTQ youth groups. Each one of these was situated in quite a different geographic location chosen for its variation. I gave each location a pseudonym, and each one differed in terms of its relative socioeconomic deprivation, its the size of its LGBTQ scene, its ethnic diversity. And as I say, I chose these locations to give me diversity, particularly in terms of my potential participants, because I wanted to consider as many intersections as possible, but also because I wanted to consider how different group settings might also inform the identities constructed within them. So I carried out interviews and focus groups with young people in each location. I'm going to be focusing just on one of them today, Oakborough. I carried out several months of ethnography in each of these groups, which means I basically joined as a researcher and hung out with the young people, building their trust gradually, also engaging in participant observation. I can talk about the ethics related to this later on if anyone's interested in that. But yeah, I essentially watched what was happening around me at each group, tried to learn how things typically work, the sorts of practices the young people engaged in together, and ultimately to try and get a sense of what it meant to be a member of each group. And then once I'd spent some time there, I interviewed young people who were willing to take part. And in total, in the project, there's 31 young people interviewed aged 12 to 20 from a range of backgrounds and holding quite a good range of different social locations. And the things I asked them about in the interviews, which is where the data comes from, was about their experiences and their views about being young queer people in England today. So that's very much the focus of the data that I've collected. And as I say, I'm going to just be talking to you today about young people from one of these groups, which was Oakborough, a big city with a somewhat diverse population, a wide range of socioeconomic groups, and a small but very present, visible LGBTQ plus scene, and young people aged 11 to 17. So onto the young people themselves. These are all AI generated images, but hopefully they help you get a sense of the otherwise disembodied voices that you hear in a moment coming from real people. So each of the young people included in the data that I'm showing you today identify under the trans umbrella as trans and or non-binary. We've got Ash, Chloe and Koa. So Ash was 17, a white working class non-binary asexual young person who'd immigrated to England from Poland in their childhood. Chloe was a 17-year-old bisexual trans girl who's white and middle class. Chloe had gone to a fee-paying school, which marks her out as quite privileged, given that only around 6% of children in England attend private school, and the vast majority of them come from very affluent families. And finally, Koa, who was a 15-year-old non-binary person who was black, working class, and identified as an asexual lesbian. Koa had also been in foster care for just over a year, telling me that they'd been rejected by their mother because of their sexuality. They tended not to talk so much about their gender identity, instead just really referring to themselves generally as gay. So I'm going to play you a brief transcript from each of these young people, offer a bit of discourse analysis, and then round up with some kind of key themes that I think help us to understand this from an intersectional perspective. We'll start with Ash, who talks here about their specific experience of being both non-binary and asexual. I'm going to play this now. If you can't hear it, those of you who are on the call right now, some of you, hopefully all of you will, but some of you might not be able to hear it, in which case just read along. And those watching a recording of this, the recording won't be playing either because of anonymity. Okay, but I will play it for you now. Okay, so throughout this extract, Ash employs negative affect to position themselves through their emotions as powerless, and they describe being both misgendered and sexualized. So we've got the words traumatizing, traumatized, and panic all being used to describe the specific experience at school where a fellow pupil addressed Ash as gorgeous, following which they went home crying. By repeating these verb forms of trauma and emphasizing the act of crying, Ash really underlines their strong negative feelings in this moment. They articulate their anguish in terms of their desire not to be misgendered. I don't want people to see me as a girl. Ash was assigned female at birth, and so their distress at being called gorgeous is a response to being viewed as a girl in this moment. And more than that, they articulate distress at being viewed as a potentially desirable girl. This explains Ash's framing of the incident as a double problem through this listing format. One, I'm a girl. Two, they sexualize me. This first problem reflects Ash's experience as a non-binary person being read as embodying heteronormative expectations of female beauty. And the second points to their asexual identity. So earlier in the interview, Ash described themselves as disgusted by sex, hence being flirted with, causing them additional specific distress. Of course, the fact that this incident happened at school, a place that Ash was compelled to be, demonstrates the intersection of their age with their gender and sexuality as well. Combined, this moment speaks to Ash's powerlessness of being subjected to cis-normative, allonormative behaviour, and this being imposed upon them in their everyday life. Next, we have Chloe, and this extract begins with her answering my question of how her peers responded whenever LGBTQ plus topics were brought up in the classroom. So from the start of this extract, we see the relevance of the private school context to Chloe's marginalisation as a trans girl. She describes her peers' responses to the inclusion of trans topics in the classroom as generally unsupportive, in that they either stayed quiet or were slightly disrespectful. And the example questions that she then provides, how could that happen? How could that be? Are framed as instances of her peers being aggressively confused. Using aggressively as a pre-modifier here implies a deliberate refusal to understand, meaning that Chloe's positioning her peers' confusion as performative. This frames the questions as intentionally provocative, but masquerading as legitimate and philosophical. And that's a strategy that allows these kids to index an intellectual identity, which would be, I assume, highly valued in a private school context. And Chloe describes the general consensus at her school being one of tolerance, so that it was okay. That's tolerance rather than inclusion, seemingly arguing that this is the best one can hope for in a private school. In this moment of cut audio, I followed up on this by asking Chloe if she thought that her school being private was relevant, and she said yes. She acknowledged that it's a stereotypical characterisation, but argues that middle-class families have more conservative views. And in this way, she frames the unsupportive nature of students at her school, where at best they're silent and tolerant, as indicative of socioeconomic privilege. What she doesn't draw on here, of course, but which is certainly relevant to her life experience overall, is her whiteness and therefore her own privilege that comes along with this. Okay, and finally, we have Koa. So as I mentioned earlier, Koa uses the label gay. They use it throughout this extract, and that reflects common practice across all four groups, actually, where I heard it used as a catch-all umbrella term, much as I would use queer. I mentioned that Koa was originally from the Gambia, which influences their accent. To my ears, at least, their accent sounds somewhat American. I'll play it for you now. There's a lot to say about this extract. I'm going to just pull a few things out in the interests of time. And the overarching theme is that Koa positions themselves as coming out immediately and frequently, despite the risks they know that this could pose to them. In fact, Koa positions themselves as boldly coming out through the repeated declarative and unmitigated construction, "I'm gay," each time emphasising the identity label to affirm its significance. They position their coming out as immediate through its close proximity to the phatic "hi," as in, "Hi, I'm this. Hi, I'm gay." So they're presenting this act as occurring whenever they meet someone new. They even claim to answer the question, "What's your second name?" with, "I'm gay," giving their queerness priority over their surname, and so positioning it as intrinsic to their identity. They also claim to challenge their interlocutors' faces by demanding to know their views on homosexuality. "Are you going to tolerate it?" And again, doing so immediately. "Hi, I'm gay. What's your view on that?" And notably, they state that their carer's not happy about that because of the stunned reaction that it provokes. So that suggests some disharmony with their foster carer. But Koa defends and describes their reason for coming out in this way as a safety thing. By determining whether someone's homophobic, Koa can avoid being in their company by telling them to "leave me alone." This imperative form with no mitigation or politeness features really illustrates their refusal to engage with those who might put them at risk. So Koa is claiming some agency in their identity positioning here. And Koa goes on to explain that they've been open to both racism and homophobia. The construction "open to," I think it implies a lack of defences and a certain vulnerability that Koa can negotiate by preemptively determining whether people are homophobic. There's a kind of hypervigilance going on here. And they speak here to their social location as a Black gay person through the construction "tied into racism," so positioning these two factors as mutually constitutive. They talked about racism and homophobia comprehensively earlier in their interview in separate terms. So their apparent surprise, where they say "for some reason," I think that relates to the specific combination of the two rather than the existence of either. But nonetheless, Koa is explicit about their multiple marginalisation on these combined grounds here, framing this as double the trouble. So, in the data that I've just run through, each of the young people's identity constructions is enabled by their positioning of themselves in relation to broader normative ideologies which constrain them. Now, that reflects an established body of research in queer linguistics, particularly in relation to trans youth. That includes work by Lars Zimmern, Anna Corwin, and myself, for example. But what I think is key here is that this analysis makes explicit the significance of other intersecting factors. And it shows that the exclusion that these young people face doesn't follow the single axis of trans marginalisation. Instead, the specific type of marginalisation that they experience differs according to their other social locations. Importantly, there are other aspects of their intersectional identities that also inform their life experience, but I'm only going to consider now those which are invoked by the young people in their talk. So thinking first about Ash, we see that their non-binary identity intersects with their experience as an asexual person in the instance of being flirted with by a boy, distressing them because it both misgenders them as female and sexualizes them. Not all asexual people experience such strong disgust towards sex, but Ash does. And of course, not all non-binary people are assigned female at birth, but Ash was. So we couldn't generalize about their experience here because other people sharing these broad identity categories might well have a very different affective response. By taking a close, thick approach to the analysis, we can see the role of intersectionality here in rendering Ash powerless, particularly in the context of school, where as a young person, they were compelled to be. For Chloe, the same approach enables us to understand the intersection of her socioeconomic privilege with her trans identity. Not only does her privilege not protect her from the broader problem of cisnormativity and transphobia, it actually serves to marginalise her in a very specific way because of being subject to this intellectualised, aggressively confused questioning in school, where, again, she's forced to be because of her age. And we see the broader significance of this in Koa's interview as well. Their experience as a racially marginalised person in care intersects with their queer identity in such a way that they've developed specific strategies of preemptively coming out to ensure their own safety, despite the face-threatening nature of this and the way in which it isolates them from their carer. The additional factor of Koa's non-binary gender doesn't come into it specifically here because they're using gay as a catch-all term, but certainly doesn't mean it doesn't impact their overall life experience, just not their identity construction in this moment. So we see that the specific type of marginalisation each of these three young people experience as trans youth differs according to different factors: their gender identity, their sexual identity, their socioeconomic status, their race, their citizenship, their family situation. And some aspects of this then contribute to the identity constructions in the data that I've shared with you today. And I'm hoping that each of these moments also demonstrate the everyday nature of intersectionality in leading some LGBTQ plus people to be marginalised in multiple and differing ways. And I think that they show why we really need to take account of this in any analysis of marginalised speakers, not just queer or trans people. And they also, I hope, demonstrate the principles that I set out earlier on. The three extracts I've shared with you today are indicative of the need to pay close attention to the ways in which one category membership informs another. We saw this in Koa's case, for example, where their strategy of anticipating and managing the homophobia they've experienced is informed by their awareness of also being racially marginalised, an intersection they see as double the trouble. We also see that we shouldn't only consider aspects of powerlessness when analysing marginalised speakers' identity constructions. In the case of Chloe, her affluence informed directly the way she positions transphobia in the private school context. So marginalisation must be key to our analyses, but by also looking at speakers' privilege, we can see how that marginalisation is reinforced. Thirdly, a thick approach where we look at individuals closely has been used here, and that's enabled me to look at the ways each young person positions themselves in relation to their own unique life experiences, as well as the broader ideologies that they're drawing on in their stance taking. I think that's shown particularly clearly in the case of Ash, whose status as assigned female at birth and whose specific orientation to asexuality combined to inform the strong affective stance taking in their interview. Despite all these young people being marginalised, they do all demonstrate some aspect of empowerment in their talk, and this relates to the fourth principle. They each resist the boxes that others wish to put them in. Koa, in particular, is active in carving out a safe space for themselves by asking people directly if they're homophobic. And in terms of my own reflexivity, of course, I differ in many key and important ways to these young people. I'm not trans, I'm not a teenager, I'm not in care, I'm not racially minoritised in the UK context. And in that sense, what I've asked in these interviews is shaped by my inevitable disconnect from some really important aspects of their lives. And actually, that was particularly clear to me when I realised after completing my fieldwork that in my interviews, I didn't ask any of my participants about their social media use. Despite it being central to the lives of young people of their generation, I just missed it because I didn't think of it being so important to me when I was their age and realizing my LGBTQ identity. Similarly, I definitely steered the conversations. I asked all the participants about school and LGBTQ phobia on the basis of my assumptions that this would be part of their lives. And in my analysis, there's certainly gaps in my perception, things I haven't noticed, things I haven't understood the significance of due to my own privilege as a white, middle-class, middle-aged cisgender person. So there are many ways in which I've influenced both the data and my analysis of it. And I just think it's vital that we engage in critical self-reflection about this if we're making big claims about the importance of an intersectional analysis. We have to consider our own intersecting social locations here. So what I'm hoping is that these principles will support the work of others hoping to conduct analyses of a wide range of marginalised speakers' identity constructions. There have been some fantastic developments in our understanding of intersectionality in the field in recent years, and what I'm trying to do here is bring these developments together and to make it explicit how they marry up to the specific approach to identity offered by the sociocultural linguistics framework, so long as we keep marginalisation central to our analyses. Hopefully, this particular case study of LGBTQ plus youth and the examples I've shared with you today, hopefully that helps to illustrate what, in my view, an intersectional sociocultural linguistic approach can entail. I'd love to answer any questions that you might have. Hopefully this was all clear, but I'm also happy to clear anything up for you. Here's the references. If you'd like these or you'd like a copy of my slides, do just let me know. I'm happy to pass them on. Thank you very much.